Hey guys, I'm Rich and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is May 11th, 2008. This is my home group and I have a sponsor and I sponsor others. I'm nervous just like Nikki. Congratulations to Nikki on 1 year, and Nikki, thanks for speaking. I guess it's just my self-centered nature, you know, to think it's all about me. But yeah, I can't believe it, 3 years sober today. I love my life, and I truly mean that today. The guy that's going to be speaking for me tonight, he was a big part of my sobriety. I really felt alone when I came into this program, and you know, there's only a few people I could talk to. Like the first year, I was judgmental. I was, depressed. I didn't want this way of life. But you know, I'm glad that this guy stuck his hand out for me. And you know, I love this guy. And with that, I'll give you Dave.
Hi, my name's Dave, and I am an alcoholic. I had finished up a project, and I was driving home, and I was saying, okay, God, what's next? I was anticipating a nice long weekend, and Rich called me up and said, June 30th is today, Dave. So I had to, like, switch gears in my mind and come down here and speak. I had this, I'm going to jump around a little bit for a second just because it's interesting to me. I have a Jekyll and Hyde kind of a past. In my teenage and early 20s, I would go back to my church because I knew there was something wrong with me and my drinking. And I'd have these conversations with the pastor. One day he came to me and he said, don't worry about yourself too much, Dave, because I had a dream about you that you'd be speaking in front of large crowds one day. I don't know that he knew this was going to be it. This is the first time. My sobriety date is 3/2/83, and it's a long way from there to here. And it was a longer way back in my drinking. I never got in too much like big legal trouble. I was not a criminal type or something, although I was around all kinds of stuff. I started drinking in suburban Long Island, New York. Mom and Dad were in church. I grew up in church, but my first sip of beer was as a child in the backyard from my dad, and the bubbles, the taste, the flavor, the feeling, it was like nothing I had ever experienced, and soda would never be good enough anymore. I got drunk my first time at a wedding in Astoria. It was a nice Polish wedding, and I danced with the cute blonde-haired girl, and I was toasted. And they were serving me at this bar, thinking it was really funny to serve this kid drinks at this bar that was off in the next room. And I remember drinking everything off of people's tables, and I got good and loaded. Despite my drinking and love for it, and weekend drinking from an early teenage year, I just kind of got through school okay. I was on my way to college, I thought. Most of my friends were, but that last year of high school, I was kind of like leaving school on free classes and getting stoned or drunk and coming back to school to finish the rest of the day. And back in the 70s, I don't know, there was freaks and hippies, and there was sports dudes, and everybody drank and smoked. And the teachers knew it, and one particular teacher would say, what are you today, drunk or stoned or both? You know, it was just like kind of accepted. DWIs weren't so serious an offense back then. They were more a slap on the wrist. I was able to talk my way out of so many incidences with the police just by making them laugh, and they'd say, get the hell out of here. They'd take my beers and tell me to get the hell out of there. But there were some incidences by the time I left high school. That circle of friends that was going on to college, I'd be drunk at parties and hitting on their girlfriends, and they didn't like that, and I kind of like was losing them, you know, that whole year. Two close friends that I kind of went through high school with, really haven't seen or talked to him since. My drinking and drugging had escalated, though, to a point where I didn't go on to college. I went from high school to the bar stool, got jobs around town. My father had stopped working in Manhattan. He had commuted into the city and worked on Wall Street, and he gave that up to buy a small family business and put us to work the last year of high school, my sister and I. I did that for a little while, too, but around that time, early after high school, with that Jekyll and Hyde thing, knowing where my crew was, the new crew, my sister's friends, they were younger than me, but they partied, and the other guys had left, so I started hanging out with them. And I always knew where they were, but I started hanging around the church there because I knew that that's really not the way that I wanted to go. Some of those friends were starting to experiment with heroin, da-da-da. Some of them were doing armed robberies. Some of them were just idiots. And I just kind of knew that I didn't want my life to go that way, so I was hanging around the church. Well, hanging around church, you suit up and show up one Sunday morning and you're out of high school. People, like, are impressed with that. I ended up dating the doctor's daughter, you know. And that was kind of like off and on. We were engaged for a year, but that was off and on for like 4 years till I was 23. And I can remember being so hungover and sick in church on Sunday morning, through some of those years, and trying to keep up his face and be something. I don't know what the hell I was trying to be. But that relationship fell apart, and I had blamed her mother for sending her away to a Christian college to get her away from me. And I was kind of hurt over that and pretty jealous and sick. And I drank a quart one day and went over and I said all kinds of evil things to her. And my other crew there, it was right around that time we had gone to a Grateful Dead concert. And my life had kind of changed because when I had been driving home after pretty much telling her I was going to kill her one day, drunk out of my mind, I decided that I was going to drive myself into a bridge abutment and because I really didn't want to meet the cops at my house. And at the last second, I decided not to do that. And I said, well, I guess I'm living on borrowed time, so I might as well do whatever I want to do. And the next 6 years, my friends that I hung out with at that time, they were saying, something was different about you after that Grateful Dead concert. It was like you were enlightened or something. No, I was 6 years of drinking my face off and just living a completely self-centered, self-absorbed, lonely, isolated life. I got engaged one more time. I was drunk in a field, and this girl asked me to marry her, and I realized afterwards that she was pregnant. That's why she was asking. She decided that she couldn't possibly face life as a young mom with a baby, with me as the dad, the drunk that I was, as she got to know me. And it only took a few months, and she got an abortion, and I wasn't really into that, but she asked me for financial assistance with that, and I did that. And a few weeks later, she called, you know, our last date, you know, it was the goodbye date. And the first one I was emotionally sick over and thought I was drinking over it. The second one, I punched my truck once and went to the bar. I had really begun to disassociate myself with human beings. I didn't have a relationship with anybody. My parents, they were kind of latent alcoholics. Their drinking had started to escalate when I was a teenager, but they didn't really notice mine. I didn't care about theirs. They didn't care about mine. They ended up divorcing about the time I was 25 or so. But they were my safe place. I would drink myself out of jobs or places to live, and I would always end up flopping back there. So they were kind of enablers in a way. I would try and keep a life and keep things, apartments and things like that, going. But that circle of friends, that crew that I went to Grateful Dead concerts with and camping and all the big parties and fun stuff, they disappeared. And they kind of all went their different ways. I was supposed to move with them, relocate to Texas at one point with about three or four of them. And I literally knew that I couldn't guarantee I could stay drunk being 1,000 miles away from home. And I said, you know, I ain't going on that trip. And I stayed home where my little world was. And my little world had gotten pretty small. I had gone into the lawn sprinkler business. And so I had a manual labor job. But I was pretty smart. And the bosses didn't know how to read blueprints. And I did. So I was kind of like running. I was a foreman and running these jobs on places like Washington Square Park in the city and golf courses and schools and things, and I knew what I was doing, but I'd always show up an hour late, and I started out making $5 an hour, and 5 years later was making $7 an hour, and I was running these big projects for them because I was a drunk, and they knew it, and so there was no advancement for me, but they were just kind of tolerating my crap, and but I got a paycheck out of it. And that lone, isolated drinking was escalating. The last 6 years, I was a daily drunk. The last 2 years, I was a daily fall-down, peeing my pants drunk. I'd start drinking, and 2 or 3 hours later, I'd be in a blackout. I wouldn't even remember. And to me, obviously, I had been up later and longer, and I don't remember how I ever got home. Hit and run had become about a way of life, and I had started to leave the car home and just use it to go back and forth to work. Guardrails, side-swiping parked cars, getting out of parallel parking situations and hitting the car in front and the one in the back. just coming out of blackouts and being in bad places. So I tried to manage my drinking by leaving the car. The guys in the bar that I could walk to, they all had 3 or 4 DWIs, and some of them had probation officers and had a pee in a cup. I was never going to pee in a cup for anybody, and it was my right to drink, and no one was ever going to tell me that I couldn't. So that was another reason to stop driving, so that I could just walk, be the street person in suburbia. It was a little suburban town, no storefronts, no city, nothing like that. I just wandered through the yards looking at people's houses and passing out in their bushes. And, they got a life in there. But along the way, a few things happened that were like bad enough. There was one bar that if I had the steam, because there was always better someplace else than Dora's, if I could get myself down to the topless bar on Sunrise Highway, I'd usually have a good time in there. I remember one time a lot of pagans went there, and the owner was hooked up with those guys, and I don't know whether it was his plan or whether it was just a vendetta or something, but somebody tossed a Molotov cocktail through the front door in the place. It was slow, though. It was just like a pop, and it was spreading around the floor. So I knew where the back door was, and I threw the owner's mattress to the side and got to the back door and let the people out. And then I went back to the bar, and I'm finishing my drink while I'm watching the place burn down. And there was one guy standing there with me, one of the pagan guys, and he said, "You better go." And I'm glad that I heeded his advice, because he jumped over the bar and hit the till, took the money. And if I hadn't left, he wouldn't have wanted a witness. It wouldn't have been just bar burns to the ground. It would have been Dave Deisenbar burns to the ground in the paper the next day. But I remember going up the next day and, looking for the pool balls to see if they had melted, Like, I just was fascinated and seemed to escape every kind of trouble that I was in. I remember another time leaving this job that I had, and for some reason I hooked up with one of the fellow workers. I had my own little show. Don't bother me, leave me alone. This is what I do over here. But I hooked up with this one guy, and we went to a whole bunch of bars. He was driving this Willie's Jeep that he had just put knobby tires on it, which had raised it up. And I remember we got thrown out of a couple bars. We were both just falling down drunk. I looked up and I saw a wall of white. A gasoline tanker had been making a U-turn in the middle of 109. It was a two-lane highway both ways. I seen the wall of white, and I just went like this, and we made a W out of the windshields with our heads. And if he hadn't put those knobby tires on, the hood wouldn't have caught, and we probably would have been decapitated. And the gasoline was on the ground. I believe he was driving, because I believe I threw him in the back, and I was doing my "it's time to go," my hit and run. I'm trying to start the thing, and the driver comes around and throws me out on the ground and says, "You'll kill us all. You've ruptured lines. There's gas all over the highway." So it was just like Hollywood, only mine didn't blow up. And the cops are standing there. They took him away in an ambulance, and I'm standing on the sidewalk, and the cops had already taken my name, and they were all lined up like this, and they were all like looking at this chaos, that's on the highway. And I decided just to take a step backwards, and nobody noticed. So I took another one. Nobody noticed again. And there was a bar on the corner, and I went in there, and I said, can I have a beer, and do you guys got a phone? And I called for a ride, and I got my beer, and I went to two more bars that night. I was living a charm. I called up at 3 in the morning to ask how the guy was doing. I figured they took him to a hospital in Nassau County, and they did, and I got somebody in the emergency room, and they said, are you the other guy that was in that thing? Everybody's looking for you. Where are you? Are you all right? I had to hang up then. But I was living a charmed life with that drinking and seemed to always escape things. But the fact of the matter is like the last 2 years of my drinking, it was just daily fall down, stinking, puking, drinking. I was drinking a quart a day every day. I would drink myself into a coma. I would come to in the morning, not wake up. Where am I? Sometimes under the neighbor's bushes because I wouldn't make it home. And I had gotten one DWI. I had fallen out of a car. The guy said, have you been drinking? I opened the door and fell on the ground. He said, you're coming with me. I said, okay. And it was a joke, and it had happened a year before. It took that long back then for them to do anything. So they had taken away my license, gave me a conditional license, and I had a six-week program class to take. It was at Farmingdale College, so I finally got to go to college. They had written the AA phone number up there, and I went home and I had two decisions: take a six-month revocation or stay with this class and not show up drunk. Because they said I walked in there from a 10-hour drunk, and they said, "We'll know if you're drinking or whatever." And I said, "Well, all right. I won't drink for 6 weeks. Get my license back so that I can get on, you know, keep my job, my foreman job, and not have other guys driving me around." And with that thought, I decided, well, I won't drink because I figured one drink and I'm going to blow the whole deal off and take the revocation, which would be a thorn in my side. It'd be a real pain in the ass, so I better not drink. So I tried it. I hadn't, and I shook apart for 3 days. My father and mother had divorced. He had lost everything due to his drinking. And I had a little urine-soaked mattress in the back in the corner of next to a bathroom and what he called a breakfast nook. It was a tiny little closet. And it had a door to the outside world, and that's where I came and went from. And I shook apart in there for 3 days, and on Monday the dead was going to come back to life. I was going to blow off my determination. I was feeling healthier. The whites in my eyes started to come back. I probably had a couple dollars in my pocket. And I figured there is absolutely nothing. I didn't want to drink, but I knew that I was going to walk up. I was going to blow off any common sense, any reason, and I was going to walk up to Dora's bar and start the whole cycle all over again. And all of a sudden, this scream welled up inside of me, and it didn't come out of my mouth. It was just this scream that I wanted to live. I didn't want to die drunk, and I wanted my life to mean something. And with those demands, the next thought was that I got that AA phone number sitting on the table. So I called Alcoholics Anonymous, and the poor guy spent 30 minutes describing to me in this small town where I lived which church it was that the AA meeting was in that night. And I went and I found that AA meeting, and I sat down, and it was a beginner's meeting. And right away, amazing things started happening for me. The guy who chaired the meeting and introduced the speaker, he was a drunk. He used to come into my father's store. He was a fall-down, stinking drunk, and he was always, his family hated him, and I would laugh at him with my tall boy beer looking at him. You idiot, you're a drunk. No wonder your family hates your guts and you can't go home tonight. And he was standing there all cleaned up in his right mind, and he was saying he had 2 years, and that gave me a little bit of hope. And they had their little beginners meeting, and some woman told a story. She was a cop's wife. She had a hell of a story. Got away with a lot of stuff, kind of like me. And then they said, anybody want to say anything? And no. And I said, well, I'm Dave, and I can't stop drinking. If you people can't help me, I'm going to die. And apparently I started blurting out some other stuff because the guy sitting next to me hit me in the side and said, shut up, not everybody drank like us. He told me later on I was blurting out half my fifth step. So I shut up, and that guy ended up becoming my first sponsor. At the end of that meeting, people walked up and gave me their phone numbers. There was a vice president of a bank. He handed me his business card with several phone numbers on it, and he said, just call any time of the day or night. Say your name is Dave and you want to speak to me, and they'll put you through. That's all you got to say. And I thanked him, and I never called that guy, but I couldn't believe it. I was probably pissing on his bushes a week before, and a vice president of a bank is giving me his phone number. And other people gave me their phone numbers. I had made a meeting in 1977. I looked around because embarrassing, stupid things had happened. Another part of the story, there's no time here to go into all of that. But I had made a meeting, and they said, don't drink and go to meetings. And I said, that's the problem. I don't know how not to drink, and what's a meeting going to do when you people are crazy and you got God on those shades, and I already know about God. We don't get along. It doesn't work out with us. A short time it'll last, but it falls apart. And this time they said, don't drink and go to meetings. And I said, where's the next meeting? And they showed me in the meeting list where I could go the next night. I was all in. There was no place else to go. I ended up joining the Deer Park group because they met three nights a week. And I figured that's more nights than the other groups in the areas. And that's the group I'll join because I need more help than most people. I'll go to the one with three nights a week. And and that's coincidentally where this guy Jay had his home group. And what I ended up learning over some time and seeing as how things worked is what I saw here: opportunities for service, opportunities to get involved. And I joined that Deer Park group. I asked Jay to be my sponsor. I never called him because guys don't call guys and talk about their day. Not in my world. But I remember being 3 months sober, and he took me out on my first speaking commitment. That's what we did in New York. You had 3 months. You signed up on a calendar in the corner of the room. You went out and spoke someplace because there was always commitments we used to share. We would go around, and people would come to us. They asked me to be coffee maker at a business meeting. I learned what business meetings were. You go there, you get a job. They put you to work. I couldn't make your coffee because I would screw it all up and ruin your night. So they said, be door greeter. Oh, my God, that was worse. I had to stand there and say, hello, my name is Dave. Welcome to the Deer Park group. And I had to say, how are you? And they would tell me. I hadn't talked to anybody in years. I hadn't written anything, talked to anybody, read anything in years. And there I was talking to people. And like I said, I had no ability to have a real relationship with another human being whatsoever. And I got out of myself. They'd tell me about their broken car or their cat, and I don't even like cats, but next week I'd ask them, how's your cat? How's your car? And I started getting involved with the world. I remember one night sitting in my home group there, the Deer Park group, greatest group in the world. Everybody should feel that way about their first home group. I sat there, and it was a pretty large group, not as big as this, but I sat in a chair, and I said, all the love they talk about in this room, I don't see any love. I'm sitting here, and not one person came over to say hello to me, you know. They were all in their cliques, and they were all talking. And I said, you know something, Dave? You sit here and you keep thinking like that, and you're going to end up back up at Dora's. You better get up and go grab somebody and say hello. And that's what I did. Eventually, my first sponsor drank. He got his third and fourth DWI. He had a real good AA rap and had even married his sponsor's daughter. But he hadn't been around steady with long-term sobriety very much. And there was this guy, they gave out Zippo lighters with your home group, with your slogan of your choice, your sobriety date, and your name on it at your 1 year. Gave a white chip and a lighter. An ice cream cake. I was always in it for the ice cream cake and a lighter. There was this guy, whenever his Zippo lighter would click, I would hear him. I would know it was Dennis going to talk, and I always loved hearing what he had to say. So when it was time, I walked over, and I said, Dennis, will you be my sponsor? And he said, yeah. And we started a journey in the steps. By 6 months, I had taken my fourth and fifth step. And there I sat. I was going on retreats. At a year sober, I opened up my own business. I had relocated a little further from my home group and joined a new home group, but I kept going back to Deer Park, my home base. And I would see the guys. I went to Matt Talbot retreats twice a year. And twice a year, I saw all those guys, all them Irish Catholic guys in the Deer Park group that got me sober. They would all be out at this retreat for 3 days. So twice a year, I'd spend 3 days with them. I went through a journey with the steps. By 2.5 years sober, I ended up having an experience with the sixth and seventh step that changed my life. I still didn't have a relationship with another human being, and finally I had a breakthrough with God, and I sat with my sponsor, my grand sponsor, on a hill at one of the Matt Talbot retreats, and I said a 7-step prayer, and it was square business, and my life changed, and I started letting people into my life. I ended up married to my AA sweetheart there, and she had come along sometime after that experience, and ended up having children. My son's a member of this group. Rich came to the old school group, and I got to watch him get sober, and I knew he was square business and that God was doing something in his life. And then when it turned out that my son needed some help, I said, "Hey, Rich, you got a new sponsee." He said, "Okay." Thank God for that. My son wasn't all in right away. It took a while, and Rich was patient. I wasn't. I was mad. I was so mad, even after he got sober, that he was staying sober and coming here. But every night he was going to meetings all over this city, but he wasn't doing the life stuff at home. He wasn't going to school. He wasn't getting a GED. He wasn't getting a job. And he ended up moving out of my house, and he ended up getting all of those things. I'm only mentioning that part of it, and I know I got to close and can't go into more, but... last year was my son's birthday, and as much as I was thanking God he was sober, and I was so glad about that, it was like, you're turning 18, you got to go. And I really couldn't do anything much for his birthday. Well, I'm so proud of him today. Things have changed. He's got a job. He's got a home. He handed me a GED certificate. He's done all the things that that I could have wanted him to do. And it's thanks to this program, this fellowship, it becoming a way of life. It's thanks to people like Rich. It's thanks to all of you people here. Your birthday present's in my truck, son. Today's his birthday. Thank you.
I'm Caitlin. I'm an alcoholic. Dr. Bob's last message, delivered at the first International Conference of Alcoholics Anonymous at Cleveland, Ohio in 1950. I get a big thrill out of looking over a vast sea of faces like this, with a feeling that possibly some small thing I did a number of years ago played an infinitely small part in making this meeting possible. I also get quite a thrill when I think that we all had the same problem. We all did the same things. We all get the same results in proportion to our zeal and enthusiasm and stick-to-itiveness. If you will pardon the injection of a personal note at this time, let me say that I have been in bed 5 of the last 7 months, and my strength has not returned as I would like. So my remarks of necessity will be very brief. But there are 2 or 3 things that flash into my mind on which it will be fitting to lay a little emphasis. One is the simplicity of our program. Let's not louse it all up with Freudian complexes and things that are interesting to the scientific mind but have very little to do with our actual AA work. Our 12 steps, which simmer down to the last, resolve themselves into words. Love and service. We understand what love is, and we understand what service is, so let's bear those 2 things in mind. Let us also remember to guard that erring member of the tongue, and if we must use it, let's use it with kindness and consideration and tolerance. And one more thing, none of us would be here today if somebody hadn't taken the time to explain things to us, to give us a little pat on the back, and to take us to a meeting or two, to have done numerous little kind and thoughtful acts on our behalf. So let us never get the degree of smug complacency so that we're not willing to extend our attempt to that help which has been so beneficial to us. To our less fortunate brothers, thank you very much.